Good morning, Tim and Jim. We just rang the bell. Yeah. So grab a seat where you're comfortable. Sue Davenport said that these orange things can go if you want. Everybody who got into the state of Maine has got to be COVID negative. So, yeah. And there's also one upstairs.
I'll go upstairs.
Oh, give me a hug. I love you, Cynthia. I love you. So good to see you.
Hi, everybody.
Hello, upstairs. That's Timmy, father of the bride.
That's true.
Yeah. Good. So normally we would start with meditation first, and that will be our business on all days, but this one is going to be slightly disrupted today because we're beginning and also because of the book signing in the afternoon. So it's going to have a slightly different shape from the other days. And what I wanted to do was separate the talk I would have given last night if we'd started last night, which I'll do in the first little bit before we meditate, and then the meditation in the slightly different format we're going to do it will be our first official move into the teaching of the thing. So we're taking a fast flashback to the last night that didn't happen, when it became clear that that enough of you were not going to get in till late, that it was absurd to think that we were going to have you all fed and socialized and get you out here for anything that you would actually remember. So welcome. Heart welcome. Look around the room and take each other in. A brilliant, trusting, joyful, courageous group of people who've come to do some work that I kind of 80% know where it's going. The rest of it will meet us. So Jacques Lousserin really wanted to be included here. So much so that I actually had to get on my little boat yesterday and go all the way up to Eagle Island to the bookshelf to pull him out. He was that insistent, and it wasn't no just check quotes. He says, my presence wants to be here with this group. And I, wandering through a few of the quotes of that, and of course, I'm assuming that most of you remember Jacques Lousserin. We chugged through And There Was Light, probably not in a Stonington Wisdom in-gathering, but in various wisdom schools along the way. A brilliant autobiography by a Frenchman, a very intuitive Frenchman, who went blind at the age of 7 through a freak accident. Very quickly learned he could see again by learning to find his imaginal insight and then filtering it out from the imaginal innermost essence of things into the outer world. And in that way picked up not only, you know, he still needed people to put an arm on the shoulder of when he was hiking in the Alps and things like that. And he never drove a car behind the wheel. So there were certain things that didn't transpose. But he did deeply see. And part of what allowed him to see, and when he saw not only the physical appearance of things, like most people do, but the moral scent of them. And he could smell, you know, as surely as most people could see, he could smell courage, he could smell lie, he could smell evil, he could smell corruption. So, and he couldn't take in an impression without also taking in the moral scent of it, and the moral scent didn't lie. So it was that combination that led him at age 13 to scent the rising tide and the moral scent of the rising phenomenon of Nazism in the 30s in Germany, and to realize that this was an insidious collective evil that had to be met. And since he knew that no French resistance group would allow him in because he was blind, he founded his own. And it was a very good group, and they gave him the job of deciding who was trustworthy. They all came to for an interview to see if they could get into the group. And because of his strong, imaginal, moral sense of things, he could usually tell who was faking and who was for real. So he only missed once. And the person he missed, his compass wavered, eventually busted him. It turned out to be a Nazi double agent, and off he went to Buchenwald, where he was, 200 went in his cattle car, and of the 200, 30 survived, and he was one of them. So the book is a horrific and yet brilliant story of how human courage, human integrity, human value can stand in the face of these incredible waves of moral sickness and dystopia that wash over our civilization regularly, and do something in a way that is collective but working individually. It's not like having a political convention and having a big movement. It's something that works more subtly than that. So I think it's for that reason that he was so insistent on joining our group from the other side. And I kept having a line rattling in the back of my head, which I couldn't quite place when I looked over the book this morning. It's in here somewhere. I know basically where it is, but I probably didn't underline it. He says, one has only to throw into the air a handful of fear to reap this year's harvest of violence and murder. And I thought, oh, yep, here we are. So, and many, many other insights about, how to actually counteract this, which directly parallel and probably influenced what we're going to be studying this week about the imaginal world. So I had thought when I started and when I was going to give this talk last night that what I envisioned for this gathering was more than just an in-gathering, more than just politely studying some material in a beautiful place. What I envisioned was actually in some conscious way constituting a conscious circle, a web, to do an intentional work together in this planet in a way which Shakespeare calls severally, which means together but individually, that so you don't merge into one big collective lump, but that each person in that web is able to holographically participate in the whole thing. And we're going to work on not only that happens, but how it happens, and we're going to practice the skills. So I thought that we would be forming a conscious circle. But I want to take it even still further and say that what we're actually doing this week in Stonington is to open our own branch of the resistance, the resistance. And that is resistance to the left and resistance to the right. Resistance to the partial truths coming on both sides, which are crippling and blighting the human spirit and the planet. And an attempt to reconnect with a higher stream of assistance and wisdom. And I say both of those in equal measure. Assistance and wisdom that that can help us be in a different way in our planet, particularly in the next 3 months, which are going to be very critical, 3 months, 6 months even, into the winter flu season and back out of it again. To be in a different way in our planet, to generate a different energy. And I'll wander back to that. But that's what I'm seeing, and that's the aim that I'm holding in my heart as we gather here. That most of you, you know, if we had done this the way we had originally thought we were going to do this, it would have happened in June. We would have had about 100 people here, and we would have gone over and broken the back on my imaginal book, which at that point wouldn't have been published. And incidentally, if you don't have any yet, we've got 30 copies out there that you can purchase. We'll see me at the break. So that's what I thought. And in wisdom schools in the past, we've basically taken the book and gone through the five main components of it. And those of you that were there at Valley Crucis, which I think is about half of you, will have been introduced to the five major parts of this teaching. Let's see if I can even remember them at this point. First of all, the map of the worlds. The second, the whole theory of imaginal exchange between the realms. The third big topic being imaginal causality. How do things fit together and how do they cause each other in this realm? The fourth being imaginal purification. What do you have to do to bring your own body, mind, soul, spirit to a level of what you might call subtlety that can pick it up and work with it? And finally, the whole teaching on the conscious circle. So those were the five components. And when we were in Valley Crucis just a couple of weeks ago, we worked really hard on probably the first four of them. We didn't do an awful lot with conscious circle except by becoming one. I said there that what I wanted to do when we got back here, so that it wasn't just a simple repeat of what went on there, is to really focus hard on a point that I just sort of circled around in Valley Crucis, which is the actual dynamics and mechanics of imaginal exchange. Because we're going to look at this later this morning, if what we really are in is a huge intercosmic self-specifying system, as scientists now call it, you know, not just our planet, but many planets, many worlds, many densities, many realms, all holding each other together and generating an energy which keeps the whole thing stable. If this happens by the exchange of certain kinds of energies and substances between the realms, what is it that we, as human beings, in a very strategic position, as we're going to see in the maps, what is it that we ought to be receiving, and what is it that we ought to be generating? And how are we falling down on the job, and what are the actual implications that you can see on the ground? So we're going to really try to connect the dots and focus in a little bit more closely on that particular piece of it. And what I would say is, you know, I knew from the moment I started writing this book that the time clock was running on it. You know, I could smell in the wind that we were in for some sort of major winnowing. The original inspiration for the book really came with I've talked about it, that revelation in Tintern Abbey on the eve of the election in 2016. When I knew exactly what was going to happen, and I had a little bit of a glimmer of where the ship was headed. Fortunately, they didn't give me the whole story, or I would have put a gun in my head right then. but I had no idea, you know, when the book was accepted for publication and really started easing into production. I think I was reading The Galleys at Laurel Catto's in February, just before all hell broke loose. Took myself off to England to be with my friends the Bennetts and work with the London group. Had a great kind of blow it all out trip to Crete in the end of February, and came back and boom, the whole thing fell apart in this town on St. Patrick's Day. When the town offices closed up, everything got shuttered, you know, and we were off and running. So at any rate, if I can recap right in one sentence right up front, so that as we sort of start wandering through some of the kind of occasionally intricate and even over intricate technology of exchange between the realms, to hang on to this piece, that I think the what is really, really missing in you know, the ingredient that's missing out of the whole energetic bag, the whole mixture that makes up the atmosphere of our planetary world, is the element of courage. And I was really trying, I laughed when I opened up the book today and saw, and I didn't even know, that Lucerand titled his pivotal chapter "The Plunge into to Courage," and talked about how it began for him with 3 days of very, very deep sickness. I thought, this is imaginal causality. But when I talk about courage, the substance of courage, you could call it the energy of courage, or the substance of courage, at this level they're essentially interchangeable. And we're going to look a little bit more about why these terms are basically interchangeable in the bandwidth where we're working. But consider that courage is a nutrient. And consider that in the presence of it, certain kinds of healing, possibility, and manifestation become possible. In the absence of it, something else happens. There's a kind of malnutrition of the human collective soul that leaves it not only more and more trapped in itself and docile, but less and less able to rescue itself from the pit that it's fallen into. You know, that you become more and more despairing and depressed and docile and tame and less courage. So the more I've sat on it, there are many others, but courage keeps coming back. And what I'm going to say is that I'm not talking about a reckless bravado courage. I'm not talking about, yeah, you get me, Mr. Coven, you know, or I got Jesus on my side, so I'm not going to die, you know. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about what I would call very specifically paschal courage. And it is the heart of the Christian mystery, you know. It's what Jesus did on the cross and modeled to us with just, you know, with a liberty with an intensity and a power that changed the planet forever. It's a courage that doesn't prevent death, but starts on the other side of death. And it doesn't start with a kind of giddy resurrection. It starts with, you know, resurrection interpreted as it often is in Christian community, kind of like the happy ending to the story. It's a deeper kind of thing that really Paul hit right on the money when he said, whether I die, whether we live or die, we are the Lord's. In other words, this strong sense that nothing possibly can fall out of God, and that there are values that are required of the human being to witness to offer back into the planet, to uphold, that are so profoundly important to the life of the whole system, that the failure to exhibit these qualities puts the whole thing in jeopardy. And that's what we're going to be looking at. Maybe even by the day we'll have a better sense of why. But for Jesus it was so crucial, you know, that we often talk about this in terms like martyrdom. But martyrdom has been misunderstood in the church. It's, you know, it's all a variation on the Islamic 69 virgins in paradise when you die. You know, it's like, you know, you give up your life here and boy, are we going to sock it to you later. But it really is something much more intimate than that. Martyrdom is the absolute realization that there's some values, there's some pieces of the face of a human being that what it means individually and collectively to have the honor of inhabiting a skin on this planet for a certain amount of time that are so brilliant and so necessary to the functioning of everything and so central to the heart of God that to betray them is to plunge everything into sickness, to degrade the whole thing. And over the past 50 years particularly, we have, first of all, incrementally and then, you know, plumbly, lost that sense in, I think, both the liberal church and the conservative church. The conservative churches have hung on to it better than the liberal churches, but pretty much for the wrong reasons. Magical thinking. The liberal church is just, you know, postmodernism, you know, there's no heaven, there's no hell, these are all just, you know, these are all just vestigial concepts. It's like Santa Claus and the Tooth Fairy. So no inducements from, you know, and heaven and hell were the only things that were left in our, you know, flattened way of looking things, of placeholders for the concept that there's a higher reality that enfolds and overarches and informs us. All true. Heaven and hell are kind of fairy tale versions of it. But it was a glimmer of something that said that your behavior, your choices, have value and significance in worlds beyond just our own. Well, that all went out. And with it came this postmodern, well, you know, we were just a fragile little, you know, random planet and a random universe and a billion big bangs and no God. No. And so it all devolves into get what you can get while you're here because it's all you got. And this protectiveness, this utter refusal to die, and then this sentimental projection of that fear onto others, calling it compassion. And that's where we're stuck. And there's, you know, and we don't know how to generate courage. You know, Eucharist stopped immediately as soon as there was any sense that, you know, that, oh my God, you know, Jesus has given us a dangerous ritual, let's not do it. And I'm not at this point arguing right or wrong. I'm arguing just let's look at what happened. And so if you read the moral stench of things even a little bit, you realize that you know that there's a lot of fear walking around, you know, on the streets. Amen. A lot of fear, a lot of suspicion of the stranger. And these have got nutritional value. So what we're going to do is look at this piece, and it's a piece that cannot be touched by either all the rational, liberal, progressive stuff you read in the Washington Post and the New York Times and the Atlantic Monthly, all good stuff, but horizontal. And it can't be touched by, science has no clue of these, you know, some of the more integral scientists are beginning to push for a certainly a larger view of COVID exactly, when seen from the planetary system. We're going to be looking at some of that in Wellen von Lee's piece tonight. But we don't have any sense left. The church has long since forgotten that their vestigial teachings on heaven and hell have any relationship to a powerful stream in the perennial wisdom of understanding that there are worlds beyond worlds, and these worlds feed each other, and these worlds are in some sense dependent on each other. And until we get that piece back, you know, and until we can say not only that the COVID pandemic reflects our absolute arrogance with regard to this planet, but also our absolute arrogance with regard to the whole inter cosmic feeding system, that we are really a dangerously invasive species, but also a dangerously, beautifully creative one on which everything depends. We do have a dish to play. We can play it. Jesus, hanging on the cross, died, loving all, forgiving all, knowing only that he could not do anything else. To say, sorry guys, I'll sign the paper and the pilot will let me off the hook and we'll start the Jesus Christ Institute for Spiritual Transformation, put it on the internet, make a killing for disciples.org. He couldn't do it. Because his sense of what was required to bring the spheres into harmony, all worlds. This is what we mean when we say Jesus is the Son of God. It means that he's not just this planet, all planets, all worlds. That he died alone, mocked, almost alone. You know, Mary Magdalene, his mother, and this centurion, who when he died took a breath and some kind of fragrance or substance was released and he said, truly, this man was the Son of God. How did he know that? I mean, what would have changed? In one moment Jesus is three quarters dead, the next moment he's dead. It's anguish all the way. And yet, at that moment, something was known. And I would maintain that the element of paschal courage was released into the world with such a mega dose that it gave us 2,000 years. And it gave us 2,000 years in which we've seen some of the highest of human behavior, as well as some of the lowest. And I'm not saying that Christianity tends this stream exclusively. I would never say that. You know, Jesus was part of an emerging phalanx of people that were trying to introduce the planet to bodhisattva consciousness, to the love from the collective. But he carries the torch in our stream. And we have, in a very deep way, abandoned, forgotten, and turned him into it. He's not Jesus the bull anymore. He's Jesus the steer, and we can manage him, but he can't reproduce. And you know, so I'm just putting this out on the table so that you know I'm not going to be teaching this from an un-Christian point of view. This is not about, you know, Christianity is deficient, and so we're going to go and find all these little esoteric goodies. Gurdjieff always said that the whole point of what he was teaching was to enable people to be a Christian. And I think he's 100% right there. And that if we could in various ways go back into our churches infused with that Christic love and courage, the planet would change in 3 weeks. So, with that in I want to talk a little bit about the component pieces of what we're up to and how our time together is basically going to work. We're weaving together, you know, where I want to take us in terms of the curriculum is, first of all, this morning we're going to work on reviewing the worlds, the two maps of the worlds, just to get that under everybody's belt, because it's the basic platform. It's our vocabulary we'll be working in. And then we're going to look particularly at what Paul called the fruits of the Spirit as the transformed substances, which are actually given by human beings in the exchange between the realms. We're going to look at the exchange, we're going to look at what's needed, and we're going to focus on these qualities and see them not just as moral virtues, but as actual energetic, substantial nutrient packets. So we'll look at that. And then moving on, particularly on Thursday, to a much more deeper dive into what paschal courage actually means, revisiting the central mystery of the Christian's faith with an eye toward the feeding and the healing of not just this world, but of all worlds. We're going to be working with the Aziz exercises and a little bit with some movements that support them. As you know, back in March when people were sheltering in place, Joseph Aziz's book with the bringing forward in a performable and workable form about 40 of the spiritual exercises that Gurdjieff was teaching to bring about a condition in the human being, a kind of awakening and balancing of intellectual, moving, and emotional centers, so that we could actually create a tripod on which our access to what I'll come to call imaginal realm, higher assistance, higher intuition could happen. So a group of people picked those up and started working with them. I wrote some commentaries for them on the web, as you know, and Andrew spearheaded getting a group together that worked really intensely there. We have several people there from that group. And we found that they made a profound difference. I mean, the people that actually took them on in our sort of wider wisdom community very quickly wound up in a different place from the people that didn't. And people said, this is interesting. And we may get a chance to talk a little bit more about life, about why that was. But we're going to be working with a few of them. Not all of them like we did, not even all six that I called out to work with in my commentaries. We're going to be working with about four of them here that have some particular strategic importance for the kind of generative, you know, resistance work that I'm proposing. So that will start right up this morning as I start centering prayer, but within the context of the atmosphere exercise. This afternoon, Andrew will pick up from atmosphere and take us into the web. We're going to have at least one and maybe 2 days with Bob leading the Make Strong exercise, an exercise that he's worked with intensely, not only during the pandemic time, but during his whole long, you know, winter ordeal with cancer. So Bob has, you know, that exercise carried Bob to some pretty amazing places. And I think it's an amazing gift of paschal courage, not only to have Bob here, but to invite Bob to teach what Bob's heart has learned in the doing of this exercise. And it does have a lot to do with breathing in some of the finer substances from worlds beyond our worlds, which sounds like voodoo to people that don't know the technology of it, but really isn't. So we'll have that piece. We're really lucky that we have Andrew Heather, who's becoming an increasingly competent movements teacher, so we're going to be working informally for those that are interested with Gurdjieff movements. And so that's another piece. The other thing we're having, which is a wonderful synchronous contribution catalyzed and sort of arranged by Buddy Parker, is we will be having a Zoom conversation with Dr. Eva Lee tomorrow evening. And Eva, you've probably read a lot of the stuff we sent around to get you up to speed on who Eva is, and we'll tell you more about that in due course. But she's one of the top infectious disease experts in the world, has been involved for many years in the group that was called the Red Dawn, that was founded, I think, was it in the George Bush administration? Yeah.
Goes back post 9/11
to
when the White House under Bush created a consortium of scientists and to deal with what George Bush truly believed would be the inevitability of a pandemic.
Yeah, yeah. So that group was in operation, and is some of the top, you know, scientists, medical practitioners, policymakers, and even though the Trump administration very quickly gutted it formally, by then the relationships had been formed, and they constituted themselves as a little group called the Red Dawn, and began sharing examples. And Eva's expertise is in modeling, very, very intricate mathematical modeling that allows you to predict with extraordinary accuracy patterns of resurgence and, you know, hotspots, as it were. And so that's Eva on one side, a very tough and respected scientist. She was quite involved in identifying, I think, the nature and composition of the SARS virus, was it? She was right in there, SARS and MERS. So she's on her own, she's also a deeply mystical being who's, during this time of pandemic, has come around, I think, in a much stronger way to see how our increasing self-alienation from the environment through, you know, processed foods and various other other ways that the American society in particular has cut itself off from the biosphere. All of that has, you know, she's seeing that as part of the sickness that we have an opportunity to address. So it's going to be a informal, semi-formal kind of dialogue, but it's an opportunity to ground truth and reality check with a respected scientist. So often what happens is that we, you know, the people that say, well, that the scientific models we're dealing with in the West don't see everything, just get into this kind of voodoo science that's, you know, based in nothing but touchy-feely, and then they immediately lose credibility. So the holding that, walking that razor's edge between the seen and the unseen in a way that's intellectually respectable as well as faithful is one of the challenges that, so we'll be playing with that too, to really see, you know, what's realistic, what's been accentuated, what hasn't been shared with us, what's been shared with a kind of deceptive spin on it, what's the future look like, what is it with vaccines, all those kind of questions that you need to really know to have some sense in the practical world about how we move forward. So those are the four components. And my final thing as I wind down this kind of intro is to suggest that it's a razor's edge we want to walk here, and that I have my own field of expertise, and I have my field where I'm not expert. You know, I do know a little bit about this whole imaginal realm and transference, that I'm not a scientist, I'm not an epidemiologist, I'm not a policymaker, and I want to walk the edge of allowing us never to lose sight of the practical implications of what we're doing. This is not just a vacation in the imaginal world. But everything in the way I've selected the material this particular time is going to feed back into what do we do when we go home. So it's got a practical focus. And on the same time, I very much don't want it to devolve into political opinions, to what Gurdjieff called wiseacring, which means when you don't know what you're talking about, sort of puffing yourself up and getting your voice a little bit louder and pretending like you do. You know, that, and I don't want it to get partisan or polarized. You know, I don't believe myself that the left has it right and the right has it wrong, and that the right is fools and idiots and the left has just got to make its position known. You know, that's not my take on things. I can see very well, and I would also say without a major infusion of a radically different kind of energy into this Planet Fest, we're in for another 4 years of Trump. And I want everybody to see why, and why that's a legitimate and perfectly, as Gurdjieff would say, law-conformable outcome of what we're actually doing, which the left absolutely can't see, because the left believes that if you get the right formulation for things, you know, if you've got the logical in place and you've phrased it correctly, that anybody who can't get on that map is an idiot, and therefore they're wrong, and therefore they're going to lose. Nope. There's something that cannot be seen by either side. And I would say that it's absolutely our obligation, if nothing else happens this week, to see that, to name it, and to hold it compassionately. Because I think that we have the capacity to bring a third force to what happens to this country. But it's almost a four-leaf clover at this point. It's going to take very, very strategic and strong work to do it. And I'm not talking about anything as simple as simply shifting the outcome of the election. You know, is it going to be Trump? Is it going to be Biden? It's a matter of shifting and reuniting in a deep way the broken heart of America at a level way, way deeper than words can find. But so what I really want to do is to bring an imaginal perspective to the present dilemma. And then rather than my imposing my opinions on the whole thing, let you draw your own opinions and work in your own kind of pods with what you've seen. That would be a good doing for me, not to try and infect my own. I know that in every movement of social change that people are required to take all positions on a phalanx. I saw this really, really keenly when women's ordination first became an issue in the Episcopal Church, like 40 years ago now. And when the issue got on the plate, people arranged themselves in slots. Sort of, there were some that were out there on the radical edge. Yeah, I'm doing it. I'm, you know, women that said, yeah, I'm there. I'm up there. Ordain me. You know, bishops that broke rank and ordained. There were a group of people that said, no, we have to abide within the rules of the church, but within this we're really going to be working for a progressive solution. There are others that says, well, you know, I don't know, this is going to lose a lot of people in the church. This is more than the church. So they started shifting to a more conservative. There were some women that got ordained and immediately turned super conservative. to try and, you know, right back to going back to traditional prayer book services, so as to reconcile, so as to show people that just because you're a woman, you didn't have to be a loud-mouth radical, you know. And in other words, and there were some that just completely opposed it, thought the whole thing was dreadful. And I think that in every social movement, every slot has to be recognized. And if you start saying, I have the right slot, and everybody else who isn't in that slot is in some sense failing, which tends to be a habit of the left, you misunderstand the sort of phalanx nature of how change happens. What really is important is to see and to understand that everybody will occupy a different position, to honor and respect what conscience leads people to, and to keep the phalanx moving forward. And I know that it's my particular niche to occupy a fairly liberal and radical and out there position on the whole thing, which I wouldn't inflict on anybody, but which I also know that I need to represent and don't take kindly to having myself being eldered for it, because I know it's part of the mix. I just drew the card. I happened to do that one, you know. So anyway, that's what I'm hoping for, that we, in this room, many of you have different responsibilities, different, you know, pastorates, organizations, and I know that you will find in your own space the positions that you're called on to take, and to take them with compassion. That my sense is that the left, the progressive, has been real weak in this element of pastoral courage, actual embodied presence. If we can get it back up and running again, that it can change the mix for everybody. So that's sort of my political take, and I'm not going to do that anymore. I'm just going to show you imaginal perspectives on things and help you make your own connections. But any comments, questions before we take a short break and then move into meditation? Hi, Jimmy.
This is so exciting, Cynthia. Yeah. Thank you for gathering us like this this morning.
Thank you for all the work that's done and for the personal commitments. I mean, if we started saying thanks, we'd be doing that for the rest of the time. You know, but thanks to Mary Ellen and Eileen for organizing it. Thanks for all of you who've come. Thanks to Bill for hosting such a fine gathering and being completely willing to put his house at our expense for the whole week. Thank you, everybody. Everybody has played a part in how fast can you say yes. And I told Joan last night that I really believe it, that in the imaginal world, with its own language, the word for yes is hoke. And so I thank Steve and April, who have been the yes people for years in this wisdom school. If any job needs to be done, they immediately say yes, which is hoke in imaginal language. So. Heart blessing. Yeah.
I just would like to ask anyone, if you have any particular question you would like Eva to address, if you could get me that before the end of the day, I'm sure you might want to think about it. Now, maybe as late as tomorrow morning, but I'll transmit them to her in advance of the Zoom conference call so she can be prepared to address them in her presentation.
Great.
So we sort of envision it like a brief lecture followed by a Q&A among all participants.
I think that's perfect, buddy. And we're still working on the logistics of how that will unfold, but we'll let you know. This afternoon, because I have a book signing over at the dry dock, and everybody, all of you know where the dry dock is. Have you located that now? It's on Main Street, you know, go past Town Hall, go past the Island Agency, the Harper Cafe, all those places, going up towards the west side of town. and you'll see it out there. It's a little building on the right side of the road as you head west out of town with purple doors and really neat boutique-y stuff. So I'll be hung up down there for a couple of hours, and because of COVID, they haven't quite figured out that they can't do the usual thing they do of a reading, but we'll find some way to pass the hours. And the way I envision it is that groups of you will, you know, two or three of you may come down at a time during that two-hour thing, just so we keep some business up and I don't die of boredom. A few have been selling in town. And they have probably, I think, about 6 copies left over there, and I've got 30 here. If you don't have a book and want to get one, you can either wait and get it over there. I'll bring my sparest reserve over there, or else buy it now, but bring it with you too, and I'll sign it then. You know, so. Okay, Bill?
I just want to say that Jacques Lucet Wong has been very busy in Charlottesville, where I live. That book somehow wound up on the recommended list just before Christmas.
Really?
And I must have seen it 3 or 4 different places. You go to a coffee shop and somebody would be reading it.
Yeah.
It really got I'd read it, you know, a few years before, but it got a boost. And I don't know why, except for that he did teach at Hollins, which isn't too far, far away. But,
yeah.
But I thought it was fascinating that it just showed up suddenly.
That's very cool to know. You know, he may be out there kicking butt.
I think he's out there. He's been busy.
And, of course, part of what you learn in the imaginal realm about the collapse of circle is that this is perfectly possible. It's where you go when you drop your physical form, you know, in a sort of really simplistic nutshell. If you've done the work of bringing something into being, which Gurdjieff called second body within yourself, which is not rocket science, you get it by leading a moral and compassionate life, basically. By living, if you live this paschal courage, you will have second body, period. End of thing. And it confers on you, essentially, immortality. I call it permanent temporary immortality within the imaginal realm. And a lot of the folks that we call saints hang out there. And their specific message, their specific job description is to go back and forth, bridge between the realms, to assist those on this side still in bodies that are needing to receive it and pull it down, and to receive that which is uploaded out of our own courage. So as we work with this, and we'll see more of this tomorrow, but we'll see that that we are met. And a lot of these people die for no good reason. I mean, Lucerand survived the concentration camp and then died a few years later in a random car crash outside of Paris. You know? But he's still obviously clearly influencing what's going on the planet. We got Thomas Keating on the other side, we got Joseph on the other side, we got Leonard Cohen on the other side. You know, we're surrounded by a cloud of witnesses. We just need to reach out. So we're going to be working on that. Yeah, Eileen.
I just wanted to share something. Some of you know, before I retired, I was principal of a small Christian school that five of us started in 1980. And I was asked to minister at their faculty retreat last Monday afternoon. And I've done that for many, many years, so I had no problem. I guess maybe I went in my own strength. But I could not believe the pain in that room. Mm-hmm. I mean, it undid me for days. It was like, you know, I've been feeling like I was processing it. So one of the administrators last night, I had a dream about him. And in the dream, he had asked me to proofread something. And a typo had come up in the word peace. And so we fixed the typo, and suddenly the two of us felt we should gather a group of people to pray, I guess related to the peace of the faculty. And then we heard the foghorn. And we listened to it and said, that's sounding the mercy of God. And I don't know if I dreamt about the foghorn or I heard it all night, but every time I heard it, it was like the mercy of God coming. I am so encouraged to go back and share with that administrator, because he knew I got blown out of the water.
Yeah. Oh, cool. Well, and this is only the beginning of a foggy week. You'll get to know the mercy well. Okay. Does anybody need to have a stretch break or go to the bathroom before we do the meditation and officially launch our study of the world? The way things are going to actually work better in this building, since we have one facility, is to go when you need to go, and at any time absent yourself to do it, because it's going to, if we have to queue up even with 17 of us, we will be. Okay, looks like everybody's fine. Yep, spread anywhere. So we will begin with meditation, but we're going to begin with, you know, the centering prayer that you're familiar with, if that's where you go. Encased within Gurdjieff's atmosphere exercise. And the atmosphere exercise is extraordinarily important, because it's going to be the basic transformational unit we work with all week. Your atmosphere is the basis on which we will form, in which you will form and become cognizant of your own already existing second body, and in which we will meld atmospheres to form a group atmosphere or a group web, which has some collective properties that don't exist in individual atmospheres. So we're working this morning with the basic unit. And here is a little bit reading from the pertinent paragraphs in Aziz. And Aziz is just copying. He's taken down transcriptions that came from Gurdjieff's students. So this is essentially getting it from Gurdjieff's mouth. So this is how the exercise works. You represent to yourself that you are surrounded by an atmosphere. Like the earth, man also has an atmosphere which surrounds him on all sides for a meter or more to a limit. Well, there's a lot to comment about in just that one little sentence. You represent to yourself that you are surrounded by an atmosphere. Well, we all kind of know this. You know, they talk about it in New Age nomenclature as your aura, right? You know, we all know that we don't stop where our physical body stops. There's an energetic field that extends out beyond a human being. That's what Gurdjieff is calling an atmosphere. And he says, it surrounds him on all sides, so that means not only laterally, but vertically as well. You know, you're in the middle of a bubble, and that bubble is your atmosphere, okay? And he says it goes out in all directions from a meter, which is about 3 feet, to a limit. And what that actually means is that when you begin to develop a fine control, there is essentially no, you know, very little limit. There's a Sufi saying that says the cosmos is vast, but the whole cosmos cannot hold the human heart. In other words, an atmosphere under control can be projected to wide horizons, okay? But normally, you know, you can count on at least, you know, 3 feet on either side, which is interestingly the space that people hit on for social distancing. So consider you're sitting in the middle of a circle that goes out 3 feet in all directions. That's your atmosphere. And when Gurdjieff says you represent to yourself, what that means is a very, very interesting term in Gurdjieffian language. It's not that you visualize it, not that you picture it with your mind, But you actually use your sensation to try, and your attention to try and extend your field of attention so that you can, quote, quote, touch it from the inside. Okay? So to represent something to yourself is not to imagine it or to conjure it up. Take your attention, place it in your solar plexus, and extend it so that you can actually taste, touch your atmosphere, okay? Get a sense of what the volume around you actually is that we're calling your atmosphere. So he then goes on to say, in the atmosphere, the associations in ordinary life, the thoughts, produce waves. Your atmosphere gets disturbed. It concentrates at certain places. It recedes. It has movements according to the direction which you impart to it. This depends on the movement of your thought. Your atmosphere is displaced in the direction your thought goes. If you think of your mother who is far away, your atmosphere moves toward the place where your mother is. So what he says is thoughts create waves in your atmosphere. And rather than just staying in that 3-foot bubble, you know, you think of your mother and all of a sudden, you know, if she's in Peoria, you're in Peoria. But what happens, and this is very interesting, because when this can be done under conscious control, this is your tool. But mostly this happens unconsciously, right? A thought enters and you start thinking it. This brings us back into what you know in centering prayer. And the next thing you know, you're gone. And then you're obsessing and the atmosphere gets more and more disturbed. Did I feed the dogs? Oh my God, you know, oh yeah, you know, and you're gone. You're out of your atmosphere. You're there with the dogs. Okay? Right? We all know this. So, but when you can make that projection of thought intentional, and an intentional extension of energy, not a visualization, then you have the power to begin to actually transmit, to place a different energy consciously in a place where you intend it to be placed. It's a very important, crucial esoteric skill, almost unheard of in this planet, and it does happen. But it starts on a prerequisite. You just can't sit down right now and say, oh, well, let's think of all the people in Wuhan and send them prayers. It doesn't work because you're doing it in fantasy and imagination and emotion. You have to be able to extend something under conscious control. So the first part of the exercise is this. When you do this exercise, you represent to yourself that this atmosphere has limits. For example, 1.5 meters, shall we say. Then you concentrate all your attention on preventing your atmosphere from escaping beyond the limit. You do not allow it to go further than that 1 meter or 1.5 meters. When you feel your atmosphere quieted, without waves, without movement, then with all your will, you suck it into yourself. You conserve yourself in this atmosphere. And we'll talk about that more at the end of the exercise. You draw it consciously into yourself. But the first part of this is to keep your attention on preventing your atmosphere from escaping beyond its limits. Staying within your atmosphere, which essentially means quieting, disassociating, as it was, from those waves of thought that grab it randomly. So what we're going to do for the next 20 minutes, just a little bit under 20 minutes, about 18 minutes, is to, from a Gurdjieffian and outer perspective, we are going to stay within our atmosphere. From a centering prayer practice, it's just what you're used to. You let go of every thought. You let go of everything that comes through without commentary, without judgment. But we let go the way we do in centering prayer. But now with the visceral sense of that this is the tool that allows us to remain within our atmosphere. that, and the job will be as fundamental, foundational work of the kind we're going to be doing, to learn to be a responsible steward of your atmosphere at all times. Not to allow emotion, thought, commentary, fear, anything to pull you out of your atmosphere. Because it's atmospheres under conscious stewardship that can consciously meet and begin to create higher units. Do I make myself clear? Okay. So we're going to practice, then we will begin the exercise. 20 minutes of silence. Little less than 20 minutes of silence. With that idea of centering prayer done as the tool for helping you to remain within your atmosphere. Okay? So, from Paulette, all of you who were at Valley Crucis know from her most recent album, Stillness from small stillness deep, deep within us. From small beginnings it flows into the living water, the ocean of God. Through our stillness, God moves. Stillness, deep, deep within us. From small beginnings it flows into the living waters. The ocean of God, through our stillness, God moves. So keep your atmosphere. I'll begin by using this opportunity to use the bathroom and then come back and join you. feel your atmosphere quietened without waves, without movement, then with all your will, suck it into yourself. You conserve yourself in this atmosphere. You conserve yourself in this atmosphere. You draw it consciously unto yourself. The more you can, the better it is. To start with, it is very tiring. So in whatever way you envision that, take that stillness, that quiet, that repose within your own atmosphere, and draw it deeper into yourself. A conscious in-breath. That is your second body. It connects way further than you know. Abide in it, whatever happens. We'll take a short, by short I mean 5 to 10 minute stretch break now, and then I'll try to teach to 11 or so, and then we'll take a longer break where you can go have coffee if you can get it or anything like that. And what I'd like to do is, given the unusual nature of today, come back at 11:30 and work till 12:30 or so, and then that still gives us a good time for lunch and a break. So if in this break you just stretch, use a bathroom, hear it.
Three to five.
I also just wanted to let you know that Nick and Molly Weiland, who couldn't be here, because they beautifully and heartfully acknowledged that their level of fear was too high to allow them to travel in person, wanted very much to be part of this. So they handmade bookmarks for each one of us. And I will simply put them up out on the table back there and allow you to go to whichever bookmark calls you. It was just a beautiful exchange because they saw they weren't there to do it, and yet they wanted so much to be here with us in heart and soul. So here are our bookmarks.
I was wondering if the Lions,
yeah, that's
like they're missing.
Yeah, they are.